Hello, this is Tom Campbell. Today is January 11th, 2014, and we're talking to Johnny Canton from WDGY Radio today. Johnny, could you give us your name, date of birth, and hometown, please?
Okay, my name is Johnny Canton, formerly John Richard Canton, born October 4th, 1941, in Kansas City, Kansas.
Where did you go to high school, and what year did you graduate?
Went to high school at Higginsville, Missouri, Higginsville High. Graduated in May of 1959.
Do you recall the very first rock and roll record you heard played on the radio?
The first one I would have to believe would have been either Chuck Berry or Little Richard. And it was broadcast over a station out of Shreveport, Louisiana. And there was a disc jockey down there who did a 15-minute show at night, 10:15 to like 10:30. He was known as Gate Mouth.
Gate Mouth?
Gate Mouth. That was his rock and roll name. And he'd do 15 minutes, and he'd play all the R&B songs, which you couldn't hear in where I lived in Missouri. He would feature these songs by Little Richard and Chuck Berry and all the R&B acts at that time, which none of the radio stations in our area would play.
What sparked your interest in the radio business?
Well, I was probably 13 or 14. I had planned to be a school teacher. And one summer evening, my parents and I were just taking a drive. And we were living in a town called Warrensburg, Missouri. And we stopped by this little radio station there, KOKO, just out of a lark, something to do. And I went in with my dad. My mom stayed in the car. We saw the announcer sitting there in his area. We were in the newsroom, and we're looking at him. And we could hear him, and he was playing songs. And it just kind of hit me, I mean, strongly, that's what I was going to do. And as we walked out of the station and got to the car, that's what I told my my dad. I said, that's what I'm going to do, is become an announcer.
And what year would that have been, Johnny?
I was 13, 14, let's say. So that would have been 55.
Okay, and as a result of that trip to the radio station, what did you do afterwards?
I put together a little radio station in my room at my parents' house, fabricated a microphone. I had a record player, a manual record player, played all three speeds, but only one at a time. And then I used my record collection, and then I went to the local radio station there and gathered up all of their old discarded news. That time we had news came over the Associated Press or United Press International News Wire, ticker, and I just brought that home. And any old commercials that they wanted to give me, commercial copy. And that's how I put together a radio show every afternoon and rehearsed.
Did anybody come to listen to you?
My mom, once in a while. And then I had a friend, who's still a friend of mine, and he would come over before my show would end. I was pretty disciplined. I would, like, if I would do 4 to 6, then I would do 4 to 6. And he would wait until 6, and then we would go out and putz around, do whatever we wanted to do.
Were your parents supportive of this?
Very supportive. My dad was a little reluctant because he thought that this is a pretty large goal. And we were near Kansas City, and that's the electronic stations that he listened to, TV and radio. And he felt that was a pretty large goal for a 14-year-old to try to achieve. But I was pretty intent on doing it. And I rehearsed and rehearsed and practiced, and then it paid off.
And what did you do after high school?
Well, I graduated, like I mentioned, in May of 59, and I wanted to immediately go to college. So we were living in this Higginsville, Missouri. Warrensburg, where we had formerly lived, had a pretty large school, Central Missouri State College at that time. Now it's a university of some kind. So I went right there to, in June of 1959, a month after I had graduated high school, and I went to school, a college, and I got a job at this KOKO.
And did you take certain classes at college that you thought would benefit you in your
radio career? I did. I did speech and dramatics as a major and English as a minor, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty active in the, I was very active in putting their college radio station on the air.
Did you work there as well as a DJ?
No, I just was kind of a programmer, behind the scenes producer type person.
So how do you get your first job in the radio business, and where was it, and what time frame was that?
Well, we were living in Higginsville. I was going to high school. I graduated from my junior year in high school, and coincidentally, my stepdad knew the program director of this KLEX radio in Lexington, Missouri, which was about 13 miles from Higginsville. In fact, the program director, Kermit Womack was his name. He lived in Higginsville, and he bowled at the local bowling center where my dad bowled, and they became friendly, and he just happened to tell this Kermit that, oh, my son's interested in broadcasting. And Kermit said, well, why don't you have him get in touch with me? And I did. He introduced me to the general manager of the station in Lexington, and his name was Ralph Metter, and he obviously looked at me and said, hey, you know, I'm sure he thought, this is a kid, we don't have a job for him. But I kept pounding on the door, and as it happened, their part-timer, the fellow who worked weekends, committed some kind of an infraction, and they had to let him go, and Kermit convinced Ralph to get in touch with me. So Ralph called me and said, would you like to go on the air at KLEX? And I said, well, sure, I would have paid him. And so that's how it started. That was May of 1958. Yeah, May 8th, as a matter of fact.
So you made your radio debut at age 16?
Yes.
Wow. And was it a rock and roll format at the station, or what
was
the format?
No, very much middle of the road, as they called it. And it was all over the road, as a matter of fact. They did news and farm and weather. But their main music was Doris Day, Perry Como, that type of thing. But they did part of my weekends on a Saturday. My weekend day Saturday started at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and went until sign off. And then Sunday started at noon to sign off. And of course, during the summer, these stations, these daytime radio stations, could broadcast until 9:15. So I was on the air a long time. But the first hour of my Saturday show, they sold to a local record shop. And it was a top tune hour. So then I could play.
It was a top 40 hour?
Yeah, yeah.
So they had 1 hour of rock and roll per week.
Yes, and Ralph Metter did not listen at all because he couldn't stand it. But that was my claim to fame in terms of being a top 40 disc jockey.
So do you recall, perchance, the very first record you played?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was I think the number one song at that time, Yakety Yak by the Coasters.
How long did you stay at KLEX in Lexington, Missouri?
I was there until June of 59. That's when I went to began college in Warrensburg. I got a job, and the general manager over there, I just walked in and played him a tape. And he said, when can you start? And I said, well, I have to give 2 weeks' notice. He says, okay, you're hired. So, and I was going to school and working at the same time. Had a pretty aggressive schedule. I got there and I did the morning show.
And this is, now what station is this?
This is in Warrensburg, KOKO.
Okay, KOKO.
So I began my day doing the mornings, like at 7 o'clock, worked to 12:30 on the air, went over to the college and did classes from 1 to 4, and then went back to the radio station and did 4:30 to 6.
That's kind of a long day.
Yeah, very long day. Plus homework, and because I've really had packed some my classes into that, that 3 hours in the afternoon to get my credits.
So what time period were you at KOKO in Warrensburg?
Until the following year, 1960, August.
What's your next move?
Well, the gentleman who owned KOKO had just purchased a station in Fort Collins, Colorado, and they had an opening. They had an opening for a news director and an on-air personality, and he wanted to know if I wanted to go, and I told him, well, I'd really wanted to pursue my college, get that over with, to have something to fall back on, and he said, well, this would be a good move for you because they got one of the best universities in the country out there, Colorado State University. He said, you can go out there and work, and then it's by September, then if you still wanted to, go to school. Well, I went out there, and work just became everything, so I didn't go to school.
So you're actually doing three jobs at this station. What are the call letters?
KZIX.
So you're the news director, the program director.
No. I was the news director and on-air personality.
Okay.
And then the program director left. And then I became program director and still on the air.
So at that point, you had three jobs.
Yeah.
And how long do you stay in Fort Collins at KZIX?
Until the following year, March of 1961.
And your next move is what?
I went to Pennsylvania. I was hired by Bill Rust, who owned some stations out east, and this was a very attractive job. And so I went to work for him in York, Pennsylvania, WNOW, AM and FM.
What was their format?
They were top 40.
So this is your first...
full-time top 40 gig, as they say.
And how long do you stay in Pennsylvania at WNOW?
Well, I was there August of 61. Bill Rust had purchased another station in Reading, Pennsylvania. And I had an offer to go to a station in Norfolk, Virginia, which was a pretty big station down there, WNOR. In fact, I drove down, talked to the program director and the manager, and they offered me the job, and I took it. And I came back to tell Bill Rust that I was leaving. And he said, no, wait a minute. He said, I just bought this station in Reading, and he said, you might find this an interesting job. So he took me over to show me this station in Reading. It was a three-station market, and this was the third rated station in the town. But he gave me a free rein to do whatever I wanted. And frankly, there was a big opening there for a top 40 radio station.
And
he just said, go with it. And so that's what I did. I decided not to take the Norfolk, Virginia job, as it turns out. And I went to Reading. And at the same time, I was working at WNOW. So I was commuting between the two.
So the station in Reading, what were the call letters?
WRAW.
And what's your time frame at that station?
I was doing 3 to 6 in the afternoon, and program director.
So you start at WRAW there in the third place, and what happens to their ratings?
I did a lot of changes, obviously. I bought a brand new jingle package, which they didn't have at all. Kind of rearranged the disc jockey staff. Got into contests, obviously played the top 40 songs, and the big ones in heavy rotation. It took us 90 days, but we became number one in 90 days.
So in 3 months,
yep.
WRAW went from third place to first place.
Yes.
Under your mm-hmm. leadership. Well, that's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, it was fun. Took a lot of work, but it was fun.
Now, I understand you also added another job at this point, writing a music column?
Yeah, it wasn't what I'd call a job. It was a kind of a labor of love, but this local newspaper wanted a column, a music column. So they came to me and thought that I would be the logical person to do it because it was a contemporary music column. And so I did that. It was once a week. It was fun.
And I also understand you actually wrote some song lyrics for some of the local bands there.
There was, one fellow I became friendly with, his name was Barry Petricoin, and he went by Barry Petri, and he had a group, and so we, I wrote a couple of songs for him, and at that time I was friendly with Frank Slay, who worked for Swan Records, and he was a big producer at that time for like Freddie Cannon and acts like that. So I got Frank to listen to Barry and his group, and then they used my songs and then published them, and we got them on a label. They didn't do that much, but they did very well in writing, as you can imagine, because Barry was a very popular guy, and he had a very, very big group in Reading.
And I understand also from a prior conversation we had that you had another job as a co-owner of a young adult club with an American Bandstand theme.
Yes. Two partners and myself put together this place we called Club Teen, and it was a three-story building. It had a kind of a drugstore main theme. And then upstairs we had a big dance floor and a stage, and then a Raskeller down at the bottom floor with no video games, obviously, since it was early 60s. But we had games of that at that time, probably ping pong and
pinball.
Maybe pool, pinball, that type of thing. And we'd bring in, on a Friday and Saturday night, we would bring in some of the local acts. Well, and when I say local, Philadelphia was only 60 miles away. And Dick Clark was still doing his Bandstand show out of Philadelphia. So we had access to a lot of the hit recording acts at the time. And I think our opening performance when we opened the Club Teen was Dee Dee Sharp when she had Mashed Potato Time as a hit.
So you're actually acting as the MC, similar to Dick Clark?
Exactly. In fact, I'd talked to Clark. I'd met him while I was there. I tried to get him to come up, and he had a contractual thing with ABC that he couldn't do stuff like that because of the Bandstand. They owned the American Bandstand, and they didn't want to spread him out.
But you're not filming your
No. This club was strictly live. We didn't even broadcast it on the air.
So what's your next move, and what time frame are we at now?
We're moving toward the latter part of 1963. My hometown area was Kansas City area, and I had always wanted to go on the air in Kansas City because of mainly a key top 40 station at that time was WHB, and I always wanted to work for Storrs Broadcasting, and they own that station in Kansas City. But I did get a call from a gentleman, Irv Schwartz, who managed KUDL, which was the second-rated top 40 station in the Kansas City area. He made an attractive offer, and bingo. So I moved there. I hated to leave Reading because it was a great, great area for me. I also wanted to take another step up and get into a bigger market, and Kansas City was logical for me because it was my hometown area.
Now, this was a top 40 format, correct?
Yes.
At KUDL?
Yes.
And I understand that they switched their format on a very fateful day in American history, November 23rd, 1963, the date of the assassination of President John Kennedy.
Yes, yes.
And what did they do with their format?
I was doing the morning show as well as being a program director there. So I was on my way home because this happened about 12:30, 1 o'clock Central Time. So I was listening to our radio station, heading home, and I was about 15, 20 minutes away from the station, maybe more. And, of course, the bulletin came on. And I immediately wanted to get in touch with our news director at KUDL. This was the station I was working at. No cell phones in those days, so I had to drive to, I think it was a filling station, service station, to get to a public phone. And I called the news director. I said, Jack, fill me in. What's going on? And he told me, and I was just shocking, you know. By this time, Kennedy had died. And I said, well, obviously, we can't continue playing rock and roll and being a fun radio station. So Jack wasn't into rock and roll, but he was into classics, and he always kept a supply of albums at the radio station where he listened to when he wanted to. And I said, Jack, why don't we make the announcement that in light of the events of the day, we are going to abandon our format, and out of respect for President Kennedy, we're going to play a lighter form of music until further notice. And no commercials, no promos, just our required station break on the hour and half hour. And that's what we did for the entire weekend. And maybe into, I think this happened, what, on a Friday? I think it was a Friday. And then, of course, the events that happened around that time. And I think we went back to our normal format on the following Monday. But I'm not sure.
And this led to you being contacted by the Xerox Corporation?
No. That came later.
Oh, that was later. Okay.
Yeah, so, I was at KUDL until the following summer. And my former boss, Bill Rust, had purchased a station in Rochester, New York, which was a big, classy 50,000-watt clear channel station. And he called to see if I would be interested in coming back to work for him. And he told me, he said, now, John, he said, this is not a top 40 radio station by any sense of the imagination. But he said, it's a big station, and it would be a feather in your cap if you wanted to work here. WHAM, the call letters. And I wasn't particularly happy with the way things were going at KUDL. So I agreed to go to work for him, and so I went to work for him at WHAM.
And what's your time period there?
I was there from June of 64 until December of 65.
Okay, and what's your next move?
But getting back to the Xerox thing.
Okay.
Xerox, that was our home headquarters in Rochester, New York. And at that time, they were a big, big company. And they still are, but they were big name brand company at that time, with the copiers being somewhat new. They got in touch with me and wanted to know if I would do a voice track for them. They were working with David Walper in a CBS production, The Making of the President.
And they wanted for me, television or for radio?
For television.
Okay.
And they wanted me to do the announcing on it. And I said, sure, why not?
So how do you wind up in Cleveland, Ohio?
There was a fella working with two guys or three guys in Cleveland. They just bought a radio station there, and they were going to kick it off. He happened to be driving upstate New York along the New York Thruway, and he was listening to me on WHAM in the afternoon. And I guess he made a note, mental note or written note, that he called me one day out of the blue and wanted to know if I would be interested in moving to Cleveland. Well, Cleveland's a pretty big city. And I thought, this might be something to think about in terms of my career. And I had been at WHAM about a year and a half, something like that. And we struck a deal, and I moved to Cleveland. It sounded like a great opportunity for this new radio station to kind of get a hold of the market and make some noise, which we did.
And that station was what?
Wixie, W-I-X-Y, Wixie 1260 on the dial.
So you arrived there in December 65,
mm-hmm.
And this is top 40.
Well, it started out as kind of an aggressive middle-of-the-road station, and they played middle-of-the-road hits at that time. Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass and artists like that, but no top 40 rock and roll songs. But that really didn't catch on, and the new owners felt that, after a month, 40 days, whatever, they thought that this is not gonna catch on. We're just going to have to go out and become a top 40 radio station and go up against two giants in the market there, WKYC at that time and WHK. But we did it, and the way we did it was we didn't have any commercials. So all we had to do was just sound happy and bright and do contests, and we had some good disc jockeys and play nothing but songs. And we grabbed it. We grabbed the market like in 40 days, something like that. It was.
How did the radio station generate income with no commercials?
Well, we didn't. So it was on their nickel. They had some deep pockets, the owners.
This was to get started, you
yes,
mean?
Yeah.
And then eventually.
Eventually, right. Once we got our name out there and became popular, then we became popular with the advertising agencies, with advertisers, bingo. Then we started having commercials.